This is 4:55 on Monday, November 4th. Okay, good morning. Two people missed, new people missing. Yeah. Names?
Lucas Holton, okay. Jordan Fazer.
All right. So, statistics, the high score was 98 out of 100. Good job. And the average was right around 80, I think. So, I was pretty happy. You know, always could be better, but pretty happy. Hello. Let's see, where's yours? No. So what I did, like I mentioned, I made a video of discussion of all the exam questions, and hopefully it works. I don't know. It opened with things that I opened it with. Didn't try it in Windows. Downloading the whole thing before it plays it? That seems ridiculous. Well, it may pop up here and start showing us. So the idea being that you have a chance to see how I would approach these problems and additional study material for the final exam. I don't really want to go over the whole exam, but if there are specific questions, I would take them. Go ahead, Joel.
On the final exam, is it going to be roughly divided equally between all the sections, or more weighted towards end of the semester?
It will be somewhat more weighted toward the end of the semester, with a few review things. You see how much I use Media Player here. Huh? Does work.
In this recorded lecture, I'm going to go over the second midterm exam for computer science /
You can't hear it, but it's talking. So, yeah, it works. If you're watching it on a Linux computer, I've had some trouble with VLC with these. Okay, it seems to get hung up on the first video frame and not go any farther, but Totem or MPlayer or something on Linux systems will play it fine. Okay, so any pressing questions on the exam? Take a listen to that and see. All right, schedule-wise, where are we? Today's the 4th. The project 2 is due next Monday. It's a holiday, so there's no class. On Wednesday and Friday of this week, the TA will be here to assist with the project, and I'd encourage you to talk with each other as well. Often for these kinds of things, just talking through the code with somebody else is enough to trigger in your own mind insight into what may be wrong, and maybe somebody else has ideas as well. So the idea is he'll be here, happy to talk through with you with things, but I'd encourage you to talk with each other about what's going on in your code as well. So the solution video here is sort of a substitute for one lecture, and two lab sessions will substitute for another lecture, and we'll call it even as far as as far as lectures go. We finished the link layer. I'm sorry I didn't record Friday's lecture, but I didn't press record at the right time. So today we're going to start in on the wireless chapter. We will kind of speed through this. The semester is surprisingly rapidly coming to a close, even though it's not even Thanksgiving yet. This is one of those strange semesters when we go away for Thanksgiving break, come back for 1 week of classes, and then have final exams. And so that's kind of shocking at this point to me. So we'll get through chapter 6 in fairly speedy order, because I want to have at least a goodly amount of time to spend on security. I think that's worthwhile. There is a security class, spends a whole semester on security, but not everybody can take that, so security is an important thing to be aware of, and we'll spend a little more time on that than mobility. Okay? And then on the end of next week, I will assign the last programming project. It's a web proxy server, and so it sort of does for the projects what the wrap-up of lecture last time did for the overview of the protocols, right? It causes you to sort of go through application layer, TCP, forking server style, which I need to talk about. So it's a programming style. It's not a networking thing, but a programming style for dealing with networking things, and we'll do that on Friday of next week. Any questions about the schedule? I think I've adjusted due dates to make sense now. I will hand out post the chapter 6 problems from the back of the book today. That's what I said I would do somewhere. Yes, today. And so you'll have those. And the proxy project currently says it's due the last regular day of classes. I may move that to after the final exam. I think everybody would appreciate that. The problem with doing that is that then there can be no grace days, because it has to be graded in time for grading due date the following week. Okay, so that's where we're headed. Let's look at so chapter 6, wireless and mobile networks. Interesting facts here. I had no idea that this was as large a ratio as it is. Wireless phones exceed wired phones by 5 to 1. That's probably worldwide, because there are many places in the world where there is no wired phone service, but there is wireless. Thinking about my own family, well, my own family, it's already 3 to 1, so it's not that far to get to 5 to 1.
The big thing that skews that is usually have like one wired phone for a family.
For a family, and one per person for individuals. Exactly. Wireless internet connected devices equal to the number of wireline internet connected devices. I suspect that's old news. I suspect that wireless internet connected devices, given that most modern wireless phones are internet-connected devices, would push this over the top. So there are two challenges being addressed in this chapter. The problems associated with wireless link layers, which are sort of fundamental to this whole space, and then there are the problems with users who move around. And they're different problems, and we'll talk about both of them in this chapter. So, very quickly, this whole section should be pretty obvious. (coughs) the typical way this works, that we experience it anyway, is that there are wireless access points that are connected to network structure, and there are, or sometimes they're called base stations, they're connected to the wired infrastructure, and they provide access for the mobile hosts. Wireless links. We've gotten used from our personal experience to thinking about wireless links as being, you know, just that sort of last hop between our device and an access point. But wireless links are also used as part of this network infrastructure sometimes. Right? When you need to get to a place that is far away, or doesn't have very good access, there may be what's called a point-to-point wireless link. It's not intended for just anybody to connect to. It's just between one point and another to connect those things up. In the power grid, where I do a lot of my communications research, wireless links are very important and have been for a very long time. If you look out on the mountains around here and see where the power lines are going across the tops of hills, you'll also often see wireless dish antennas at the tops of those hills associated with the power lines, because they're using that point-to-point communication along the power lines to provide their access to remote locations. Okay, as with wired networks, in the case of an access point with many users, will have a need for a multiple access protocol to coordinate use of the link and to avoid destruction of data due to collisions. And there are just a whole lot of different data rates and transmission distances. And it's a lot more varied even than in the wired and fiber optic space, because different frequencies have different characteristics, different transmission characteristics, and different interference characteristics, and different, just a lot of different things happen here. So frequencies. So typically, wireless communications operates on radio frequencies, often called the very high frequency band, or even ultra high frequency bands, and they operate at different data rates. So down at the lower end of things, we have the 2G and 2.5G cellular kinds of technologies, which aren't very good for data at all, but they have pretty good long outdoor range. Indoors, we have 802.15. We almost never hear about that anymore. But then we have the 802.11 family, the wireless internet stuff that we're all used to, in various flavors, okay, B, A, G, and N, that operate at different data rates. And then outdoors, some of those same technologies actually operate in point-to-point mode. So the 802.11 ANG in point-to-point mode can give you, you know, really decent data rates over quite long distances. 4G phones, how many people have 4G phones? Yeah, you all do and I don't.
That's okay.
What?
That's okay. I also have
I'm such a cheapskate.
I also have a rotary dial tone, so now I'm old fashioned too.
I think this is different because this is the LTWE.
Uh-huh.
The 4G is like 20 megabit data.
20 megabit data?
Yeah.
So, anyway. Yeah, there's 4G and then there's 4G. This WiMAX thing has been just over the horizon as a public service for a long time and never really seems to get there. As far as I can tell. Although people, again, in the power grid are talking about using point-to-point private installations of WiMAX technologies to do things. So that could be fun. But, you know, we are today sort of operating in a space where wireless on our phones, on these little devices that just have batteries, we get data rates that are a thousand times what we were, the best we ever got over ordinary telephone lines with modems like 15 years ago. It's just quite amazing. Who knows what is going to come of this. The other thing I suppose that you could think about for wireless would be some sort of optical transmission scheme. But light actually doesn't go through air all that well. Goes much better through fibers than it does through air, and so I don't know of anything that really makes use of wireless for data communication except in the very, very short range. I played with that once upon a time, and it was interesting. Although, you know, one thing that people are talking about with these new LED light bulbs, they're essentially integrated circuits, and they're talking about putting sort of infrared communications capabilities as part of the things that you just screw into your light fixtures, and then you could remotely control the bulbs individually. They could talk to each other, all kinds of cool things using optical stuff.
Wireless is that it kind of dissipates, right? Isn't
well, everything that? Dissipates.
Okay.
Everything dissipates, but light is interfered with by water vapor in particular quite a bit. So, all right. So we talk about wireless networks operating in infrastructure mode. That essentially means that there's a base station that deals with connecting the mobile devices into the wired world, and also deals with mobile devices that move around and maintaining connections. So this is another thing that's gotten a lot better over the last 20 years that cell phones have really been in use, is that it used to be that as you move from one cell to another, things would get dropped a lot more frequently than they do now. The other kind of wireless networks are called ad hoc networks. Basically, you have a lot of nodes, and they just sort of organize themselves into a network to talk amongst themselves. I think they're sort of wrong in, there's something they said here on these slides. Let's see if it's on the next slide. Yeah, it's on the next slide. An ad hoc network can nevertheless be connected into the into the wired network if one of these nodes playing ad hoc wireless is willing to act as a router. Okay. It won't act as a base station, but it might act as a router. So a table. So sometimes sometimes wireless systems are even built to have the individual mobile nodes communicate through multiple hops to get to the base station. And these are called mesh networks. They've been built, they've been experimented with in the Boston area. The MIT folks were big on putting these little devices on tops of buildings to do wireless. Sort of around the community and provide free internet access to people through these. But we're much more used to the single hop version in which we talk directly to a base station that's talked to the wired, that's attached to the wired network.
Those little devices are basically retransmitters?
Yeah, they take in packets from one antenna and squirt them out, and they address them, they try to sort of in a somewhat organized, but not obsessively so, way move the data toward the place where it's going. So they're not mainly about optimal paths. They're about sort of getting the data there. The other place that
that these kinds of networks crop up
is in what are called sensor networks. You have little devices that are sort of installed in an environment to measure something about the environment, such as rainfall, vibration, and they're scattered around the environment, and then they talk to each other in order to move their data to the place where it will be used. The Defense Department is very interested in those kinds of networks because they're interested in the ability to sort of fly over an area, drop out little devices that will last for a few hours, and sense for sort of truck or tank traffic moving through an area and report. Just another way to pollute the environment by throwing electronics into it willy-nilly. Okay, wireless links. We've got to talk about the characteristics of wireless, why it's problematic, or what some of the problems are associated with doing things wirelessly. So, radio signals attenuate as they attenuate means get weaker as they propagate through matter. That's called path loss. So different frequencies of radio waves attenuate differently in different kinds of matter. So in air, radio waves are not so much absorbed. In fog, some kinds of radio waves are absorbed. Concrete, wood, reinforced concrete are all sort of killers for radio signals, and that's why we need to have in this building access points in pretty much every room in order to provide wireless service, because although the distances may not be so great, there are lots of these very attenuating walls. The other thing that happens with radio signals is that although they don't attenuate, they disperse, right? So do you remember from physics, if you put an antenna down someplace, you put an antenna in free space, and you just propagate a signal outward in all directions, how does the signal strength decrease with distance?
Cubically,
indeed, because the volume grows as, wait a second. No, square as a square. Sorry, it's not the volume. It's the area. The area over which the signal is being detected gets expanded as the square of the radius, and so the signal strength in any given section of it falls off as the square of the distance. Certain kinds of antennas, like point-to-point antennas, will really try to confine the signal to something closer to a line. Although in fact it still spreads, and so it's more like a cone, and so it still does decrease as you go along there. Interference is another big problem, but largely dealt with these days using various kinds of modulation tricks. But one of the problems is that the frequencies, the radio frequencies on which this kind of service operates is limited. The number of frequencies are limited because radio frequencies are typically licensed to users. This is called unlicensed spectrum, which means that anybody can use it, but the cost you pay for anybody can use it is anybody can use it. right? And so cause interference. You must be willing to accept the interference of others. And then another thing that happens that we don't see in wired networks is that radio signals tend to bounce off of things. And so you can have a signal that's received directly line of sight and another one that has bounced off an obstacle. And so you hear the same thing twice. You hear the direct signal and you hear the reflected signal somewhat later. And that causes self-interference, right? That's the issue there. Okay, so it's all challenging. an important concept in all of this. It actually applies to wired networks as well, but again, not as dramatically, is that of the signal-to-noise ratio. Basically, it says every communication channel has some noise on it, and your ability to extract intelligence out of a signal depends on how much stronger the signal is than the noise. And the point of this diagram is to show you the trade-off between the signal-to-noise ratio, how much more signal than noise, and the bit error rate. So the characteristics also depend on the particular kinds of modulation that's being used here. We're not going to get into modulation. That's for the electronics or the electrical engineering communications class. But notice that so just a little bit of additional information here. A signal to noise ratio of 10 decibels means that the signal is 10 times stronger than the noise, basically. There's a fudge factor involved there, but 10 times stronger than the noise. So when the signal is equal to the noise, the bit error rate for this BPSK modulation scheme is about, what, 1 in 50? One bit in 50 will have an error in it. Makes it really hard to communicate, right? You have that many errors. At looks like 8 decibels, so not quite 10 times stronger, 10 to the minus 7 bit error. So you can send 10 million bits and not have an error. But that's only 1 megabit per second. In order to go faster, you need essentially stronger signals in order to achieve adequate bit error rates. Okay? So you have to choose, there are a lot of choices in the design of the cell phone chips. There are a lot of patents that have been created over the recent years on different kinds of schemes for doing this, and that's partly why cell phones are as expensive as they are, is because you have to pay the clever people to invent those things. Okay, so here's just a few things that go on with wireless networks. So the hidden terminal problem is a very famous one that you always ask about on exams. So, hint, hint, hint. Hidden terminal problem. Suppose I have 3 radio stations. Station B here can hear both Station A and Station C just fine, has clear line of sight to them, no problems, short distances, not an issue. But in between A and C, there's a mountain range that absorbs radio signals. That means that when A and C are transmitting, they're completely unaware of each other, and therefore B hears what they say as noise, because they're always colliding with each other. So one of the problems to be solved in wireless networks is how to deal with the hidden terminal problem. This is a sort of graphical picture of the same thing, suggesting that in the space between A and C, the signals drop off due to the mountain ranges. Notice this can happen even without a mountain range if A, B, and C are strung out in a line, right? Because C will be much farther from A than B is. quite sure why this little section is placed exactly right here in this set of slides. I've been baffled by that for years. Code division multiple access. So remember, got to sort of rewind the class all the way back to chapter 1, right? Remember anything about chapter 1?
Came before chapter
2. What was the title? I think it was called Introduction or something like that. Overview or something like that. We talked about how to share a channel.
That's right.
Right? Remember?
Yeah.
We talked about so-called frequency division multiple access and what? And time division multiple access. Right? So time division multiple access is when you have a channel, shared resource, and I use it for a while, and then you use it for a while, and then he uses it for a while, and so on and so forth. So you just take turns using the channel. Frequency division multiple access is when we have a wire or a fiber or something, and I sing on one note and you sing on another note, or I sing in one color and you sing in a different color. All right. And by that method, share the channel. This code division multiple access is something that has everybody sort of sending at the same time, on the same frequency, but introducing some pseudo-random noise to the signal that it turns out when multiple users use the channel, the codes sort of cancel each other out, and somebody who knows the code that you're using can pick up your signal and see the other signal as just a lower level of noise. Okay, so how does it work? So the code is something that changes at a higher frequency than the data values do. So the data values here go back and forth between minus 1 and 1, probably representing actually 0 and 1. And the code gets multiplied by the data, producing the thing that's actually transmitted on the channel. Oh, they're so clever. Okay, so if you then multiply the code again by the thing that's there, what do you get? You get one every time. Okay, so this thing that was transmitted actually comes out as a very solid looking one. And similarly, this one comes out as a very solid looking minus one. Okay. So that's And notice that it's really done as the sum of these things, so that if there's interference, what's going to happen is this sum is going to get less one-like or less minus one-like as things go. But when we look at two senders going at once, the channel sort of mixes them together. Multiply them out, you sum them. Yeah?
Could you interpret the equation? I couldn't understand the equation.
This equation?
Yeah.
It says take the values from the that have been received.
Okay.
Multiply them by the code that I'm looking at. Okay? Yeah. By my code as opposed to his code.
It's kind of
like a ciphery thing, but it's not done for the purpose of secrecy.
Right.
In this case, this kind of thing can also be done for the purpose of secrecy. But in this case, it's just done to disambiguate the two signals. Okay? And so, when you do that, you get some noise and get back your original signal. So, what's the advantage of this? Well, this is a way to have lots of people using the same channel. They don't have to coordinate with each other, because once you sync up on the codes, the sender and receiver just sort of do this multiplication thing and recover the signal. But it does introduce some noise in the channel. So that's one of the techniques. But why that's right here in the chapter, I don't know. That's just kind of weird. Because there are other ways of doing signal processing. There's also things about transmitting redundancy in the data stream so that you can recover from bit errors, like we talked about for link layer before. There's things about transmitting multiple, not thinking of transmitting as going on between values just 0 and 1 or minus 1 and 1, but intermediate levels in between. If you want to know about this stuff, you have to take the EE communication theory class. It's all statistics and other things like that. Anybody in EE? Have you taken that class?
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
I think it could be fun. My daughter took a class like that, and she said, if I ever go to graduate school, that's what I want to do it in. So that seemed like a pretty good recommendation. I think those guys... and those are the guys that have enabled all of this cellular stuff. I mean, forget the computer science folks. I mean, in some sense, that's not where the action has been. The action has been in designing these coding schemes and figuring out how to build chips to implement them so that they're low cost. Anyway. All right. Moving on to LANs. 802.11. So what is this 802.3 and 802.11 business? These are standards numbers from the IEEE. The IEEE Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers is a worldwide organization now. It used to be just North American, but now worldwide, that has many different activities to create standards associated with communications, electrical power, physical form factors of devices. You know, when you buy a resistor, how good does it have to be to meet a certain standard? Those standards are often from the IEEE. They're also a major publisher of research in fields like this. So lots of things going on. The standardization process is a very political one. You might imagine that a company that has invented something would both like it to become standard and not like anybody else to be able to make it. And so there are lots of games played in the standardization process about trying to get optimal placement of standards for the different parties who participate. Usually standards are made in voluntary settings. You only play if you want to play, but people recognize that there are advantages. So 802.11n, remember how many years we sat and waited while there was 802.11n, draft 1, draft 2, draft 3. I think they finally made it to the final version, but if you bought the early versions, they might or might not work with the final standardized versions. What else? So, gigahertz, billions of cycles per second, the radio frequencies, different bands, different speeds. This 802.11n thing actually gets its much higher speeds by using multiple antennas and sending multiple signal streams that get combined into the overall stream. Very fancy stuff.
AC?
Gigabit wireless. Okay. I don't have one of those. Okay, so letters that you should recognize, CSMA. We talked about that. Carrier sends multiple access, right? This is the idea that you're supposed to listen on the radio before you talk. Okay? With Ethernet, this was followed by / and CD, which stood for collision detection. This is the stuff that Dr. Gamage talked about. Okay? So with collision detection, you listen while you're transmitting and see if somebody else is also transmitting. With collision avoidance, it's not that good. You're not able to listen while you're transmitting, and we'll talk about why. So you have to use other techniques to try to avoid collisions. Remember the problem with collisions. What's the problem with collisions? What happens when collisions happen?
In the wireless sense?
Anywhere.
You lose data.
Well, you lose data, but you sort of design things so you end up not losing data. But why don't you want collisions to happen? It decreases bandwidth. Yeah, and increases latency too. But basically collisions mean that you're using the channel to do something that's useless for a period of time, and you'd like to avoid doing that. So collision detection for wired networks and collision avoidance for wireless, we'll talk about how that works. And you can do it in base stations or ad hoc. Quickly then, terminology, a particular base station talks to a particular set of hosts, and they make up what's called a basic service set, which in a cellular infrastructure would be called a cell. The access points are wired to hub switches or routers. And if, so here's a question for you that you should know the answer to. If this is a switch, what do you know about the IP network associated with those two BSSs? Same subnet, right? Because it's a switch. If it's a router, they could be different subnets. So you can have many BSSs on the same subnet. And that's the way this building is set up. Lots of that. So technical detail, there are 11 channels that are used for 802.11b and G, anyway. And when you set up an access point, you choose one of them, or you let the access point choose for itself. Try to minimize interference. The problem is, again, multiple signals on the same frequency cause interference. Useless time, all right? And so when a host comes into one of these things, it goes through a process that's called associating with the base station. That means that the host is only going to talk to that base station for a period of time. Eventually, if that base station goes out of range, it will have to attach to a different one. And then we have to do authentication, and on this campus anyway, to use our wireless, and my laptop won't authenticate to at least the machines upstairs, and it's a pain in the neck. So let's take a look. We're essentially out of time, so let's see. What do I want to do here? So I guess what we'll do is we'll just pick up at this place next time that I see you, which will be a week from Wednesday. Remember, Monday is a holiday, and I'm gone. I'm gone 2 days, so I'll see you a week from Wednesday. We'll pick up at this place and try to get through the essentials of this so that we can move on to security. Yeah, Eileen?
Are you still going to have office hours despite not being?
I will have office hours today, but I will not be here after today. Okay? So, Hawk will be here for working on the project. If you're still worried or want to ask me a question, email me. I will have email. Hi there.
I got here late. Can I get my test?
You may.
Cool.
You are.
Justin's on.